This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Hello, welcome to Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. I'm your host, Claire, and we've got an important mission this month. It is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and we're shedding light on a crucial issue. Brain tumors claim more lives among children and adults under 40 than any other cancer. Shockingly, only 1% of the national spend on cancer research is allocated to this silent threat. Because today, right here on Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show, we're taking a stand. We're not just talking statistics. We're sharing stories, real heartfelt stories from people all around the globe who have been touched by a brain tumor. It's time to raise our voices and spread the word. By listening in, you're joining a movement to make a difference. I had the pleasure of speaking to Molly the other day, and she shared her experience when she was diagnosed with an astrocytoma. This was pre-recorded. This is our conversation, and I hope you're inspired.
We were going to my friend's 18th birthday, and it's one of these things where it's like, if one thing hadn't have happened, then I wouldn't be here now. Around the time that we were going, I couldn't really afford it, and we were moving house the week after, so I had loads of packing to do. And I kept thinking, I need to tell her that I'm not going to go, but it was hard to tell her because we were going for her birthday. And then it was getting closer and closer. And one day, I'm like, I'm going to tell her today that I can't go. And she comes into college that morning. Mum booked the fourth part tickets last night. I'm like, I have to go now. I can't let her mum go. I hate the idea of parents not liking me. So I was like, I've got to go now. So I went, and I noticed after going on a few of like the big rides, like where you like bash your head around a bit. I had a bit of a headache, but I thought it was just normal and didn't think anything of it at all. Didn't even bring it up to my friends because the headache went away pretty quickly. I thought, that's normal. I've just been on a ride that's hit my head around. And then the thought only ever came together, though, when my brain surgeon was asking me, when did you start noticing your symptoms? And of course, typical 18-year-old in the hospital, I looked to my mum to answer the question. My mum was like, she was like, probably around the time that you went to Thorpe Park, weren't it? And I was like, yeah, it probably was. Around the time that I went to Thorpe Park and we moved into the new house. Mm. And my surgeon was like, did you go on any of the big roller coasters at Thorpe Park? I was like, yeah, I went on all of them. And he said, did you notice anything afterwards? I said, I got a headache after a couple of them, but they went away pretty quick. And he said, that saved my life because the G-force from those roller coasters will have moved the tumour from where it wasn't causing any symptoms to somewhere where it was causing symptoms. And he said, where it would have originally been growing, by the time it would have got big enough to cause symptoms, it probably would have been too late to do anything about it. At the time, we lived in a town called Newton Abbott, but I was working at college in a town called Paignton, which is where I live now. And so I stayed at a doctor's surgery in Paignton because it was easier. So if I needed to go halfway through the day, it wouldn't take me an hour on the bus to get there. I could just go halfway through the day of college and go back. Mm. And I saw all of the GPs at that surgery because at first it was just I was being sick for no reason. And they're like, is there a chance you could be pregnant? I'm like, no. And then they were like, They decided to start testing me for allergies. Tested to see if I was celiac twice in 1 week. I'm like, if I've not got the allergy on a Thursday, I'm not going to have it on a Friday ever. If I'm not allergic to it on a Tuesday, there's no way that suddenly on a Friday you need to test me again and it might show up. But then, and then because they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, they sent me to another, like a sister surgery. And they, again, just kept testing me for the same sort of things that I'd already been tested for. So at this point, I wasn't getting anywhere. I was really tired as well. Like I'd come home from college or work, I'd go to sleep, and then my mum would wake me up, I'd have some dinner, and then I'd go straight back to sleep and sleep through till the next morning. So we knew something weren't right then. I finally went to a GP surgery with my mum. My mum came with me because she was like, they're not taking you seriously, I'm going to come with them and make them take you seriously. Changed surgeries, my mum came with me, and within 5 minutes, the doctor had picked up on the fact that as soon as I walked in and spoke to her, before my mum even saying about my face, the doctor had picked up on that straight away. As soon as I spoke to her, she noticed straight away that there's something not right with my face. So she was already getting ready to refer me to the hospital. She was thinking this could be a brain tumor. She got me to look at her eye and just keep looking at her eye. And from the side of me, she was like, tell me when you can see my finger.
Yeah.
And she slowly moved her finger in. From the right hand side, I could see it really far out. Mm. But from the left hand side, I couldn't see it till it was right in front of me. And then my mum started to really panic, thinking, oh my God, Molly's lost half of her eyesight and we didn't even know.
Yeah.
But then straight away, the GP was like, I'm going to refer you to the hospital tomorrow for an MRI scan to rule out a brain tumour. But what's odd, though, is I left that appointment actually hoping that it was a brain tumour because I'd been so ill for so long.
Just want answers.
And for so long, it was looking like I was never going to find out and I was just going to be feeling that ill for the rest of my life. But there was part of me thinking, if this is a brain tumour, at least we know what it is and I can actually get better. And we can actually work on making me feel better and everything. And then, so then the next morning, we went for an MRI. We went to the hospital. And my mum's boyfriend, cleverly, he said, pack a bag just in case it is the case they find anything on there and they want to keep you in overnight. So I packed a bag. So I'd already gone there with a bag. Me and my mum had already gone there with stuff and everything. And so we got there. We're waiting in the waiting room for ages. And we'd been speaking to a doctor before I went down for the MRI because obviously I'd never had one. I've never had anything wrong with me ever. The doctor in the hospital is running through me what the MRI will be and everything and saying, we'll get the results that day. And eventually, I get taken down to MRI, which blew my mind that at this point, there's nothing wrong with me. I've not been diagnosed with anything, but I went everywhere by wheelchair. They pushed me everywhere in a wheelchair. I'm like, I can walk. And they're like, yeah, but it's... And they're like, no, we've got to take you there in a wheelchair. I'm like, that seems crazy that I could have just walked down there quicker. But they were like, no, we've got to take you in a wheelchair. And I'm like, there's nothing wrong with my legs work fine. So I go down to MRI after the MRI, then they take me back up to the waiting room. Me and I just sat there for ages. And then the doctor that we'd been dealing with all day went into the room with another doctor. And I said to him, I said, if they call me in now, it's not good news. And then they called my name. So they start telling me that they found a large mass in the middle of your brain. And I had to look at my mum and go, does that mean brain tumour? She said, yeah, it does mean brain tumour. The other doctor was in there because they wanted her to do a breast examination on me and stuff because often brain tumours are often secondary tumours, or they were worried that it could have spread and could be somewhere else. So then they did. So obviously they did. She obviously had a good feel around, and she couldn't find anything. But then of course they gave us two options. They said either you can stay in, or you can go back home and wait till. Because the thing was, that was at my local hospital. That was at Torbay Hospital, which is just like a small local hospital, really. Like, you can go there, you can have x-ray done there and stuff like that, but you can't have, brain surgery done there. So my nearest hospital was Plymouth, Hereford in Plymouth. But I had to wait till a bed came free at Hereford. So they said, either you can stay in here, or you can go home and we'll let you know when a bed comes free. And I said to my mum, they said, we'll go outside and we'll let you discuss it. And I said to my mum, me and my mum both decided that we felt safer me being in hospital because now knowing I have a brain tumour, anything happens, we're going to be panicking. They were worried, even though I never had that, they were also worried that there was the risk of seizures. And I luckily never had one, but of course my mum didn't want me to be at home and have a seizure or something and I not really know what to do. Mm. Whereas if I'm in hospital, they know. So if we stayed in, luckily, and I thought this was so lovely because they knew that I was 18. I'm on an adult ward as a young person. They got me a little side room. But they brought an extra bed in so my mum could come and stay with me.
Oh, that's lovely.
I thought this was nice as well. Every time we had meals, everything, it was great. Every time we had anything, they were happy there for my mum to be there and do everything with me or whatever. Because, one, I guess it makes it easier for them because they don't have to keep checking on me all the time and making sure I'm all right because my mum's in there with me. But also so that they know that I've got somebody with me and that I'm not, obviously, so that she's not at home worried about me and that I'm not worried because I'm in hospital for the first time ever. So I stayed in Torbay Hospital for a couple of days, but then finally a bed came free at Hereford. So they sent me over there and I got to meet my brain surgeon, who is my absolute hero.
Mm-hmm.
Which one? He's a man called Titus Barret.
That's a great name.
He told me the meaning behind his name. He said he's named after a Roman emperor.
That's what I mean. I was like, that's a good name.
Yeah. But he said, Titus, the Roman emperor, said if he didn't help somebody every day, that was a day wasted. I'm like, what a name for a man who's a brain surgeon.
Wow.
It is. I've always said, if I ever have children, my firstborn son will be Titus for sure, because because that man's my hero. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't still be here. And he was always trying to put my mind at ease, knowing that obviously I've never had any kind of illness or anything.
Hmm.
But you know the saying as well, not all heroes wear cape.
Definitely.
Especially because when they sent my case over to Hereford Hospital to discuss what surgeon was going to take on my case, they were all looking at it going, oh no, that's too risky. Because the problem was, by the time I was diagnosed, my brain tumour was the size of a Satsuma. And it was right in the middle of my brain. And there was, obviously, before I went in, I had signed consent forms that said, obviously, there's risk that I'm not coming out of this. There's risk that I'm not going to come out of this alive and stuff. And also signing forms say there's risk that I might wake up and not be able to speak, might not be able to see, might not be able to move or anything, and all these risks. which is terrifying as an 18-year-old to think of all these things that could happen. I just took on my case. He took on my case despite the fact that none of the other ones were willing to try it. And so he took it on and everything. And I had my fifth brain surgery. It was actually scheduled for my 19th birthday. And then it got cancelled on the day. We spent all day waiting for them to take me down to surgery. And I was meant to go down first. And it was getting later and later in the day. I'm thinking, it's not going to happen today. It's not going to happen. And she realised it wasn't. The moment when she realised it wasn't going to happen, one nurse came in to get me and another one went, I'm not taking her yet. And my mum was like, there's something not right here. And then they came to see me and they said that because the risk of CJD, mad cow disease, if they've used a tool on somebody born before a certain date, and a chance that person could have eaten meat affected by mad cow disease, so they can't use it on somebody born after that date.
I've never heard.
And they didn't have a tool that would somebody had used the tool for people like the younger people on somebody who was older, so they didn't actually have the tools they needed for the surgery. And then I had to wait for them to finally get the tool from Germany. And then finally it came in about a week and a half later. So then I went in for the surgery. It was an 8.5-hour long brain surgery. He got in and then realised at this point there was still so much more that he had to do that he was, and like, he knew that he couldn't do it all in that day. It was not going to be possible to do it all that day. So he realised at this point, best option was to finish where he was, stitch me back up and then get me back in a few months later. So the first time I was asleep for it, they told me they were going to wake me up in it, but then they didn't get to the point of waking me up in it because there was so much more to do when he got in there than he realised. It was more complex than he thought. And then, so then I went back home and then about 4 months later, I went in for my second brain surgery. That one, I was awake during.
What was that like?
See, that's the thing. Most people don't remember it. I don't remember it at all because the problem is, it's such a traumatic thing that your brain blocks out the experience of it. But I kept having these really vivid dreams of brain surgery and I thought that's weird. And I kept having these dreams and they were horrible and I just couldn't wake myself up and get out of these dreams.
Mm.
And I started to be, there was a, me, during the surgery, there's a neuropsychologist there to do the awake part. So I went to see him and said, look, I'm having these really vivid dreams of my brain surgery. And he said to me, they're not dreams. What it is, it's that because when I'm asleep, like your guard goes down a bit. So he was saying that what it actually is that it's because my guard's down, that's my brain replaying the memory to me. I woke up after that one. They'd removed as much as they could. But Titus came to us afterwards and said, look, I can't remove all of it because it would be like the original part because it started on the optic nerve. That bit was so tangled in my optic nerve that to remove it all, I would have gone blind. He said, there's such a small amount of it left. And because it was a grade one, it was a benign tumor, he said it should never grow back again. So of course he was like, I'll just leave that in there and it should never cause you any issues. Obviously we'll monitor it and check it doesn't grow back. But one thing my mum always tells me though, and she told me to tell this story on here, is that when I woke up from my first surgery, I would still to this day will be a mystery. I'll still always be annoyed that I don't know what happened, but mom came in to see me and apparently quite loudly I went, Mavis across the bed across from me. It's a fucking nightmare. I don't know what she'd done. Really annoying me. There was an old woman in the bed across from me and she was really irritating me and I don't know what she'd done, but the fact that the first thing I said to my mum, she looked over and she was like, it's that lady in the bed across. Although they'd shut the curtains on her at this point because she clearly was doing something that was quite annoying. But then I woke up from the second brain surgery. And I had absolutely no movement in the left side of my body at all. Like left leg didn't work, left arm didn't work.
Could you feel any sensation or did it just feel numb?
Yeah, I could, because one of the first things I did was, when my mum told me about this, oddly enough, the first thing I actually said as a response was, how am I going to walk down the aisle again? How am I ever going to live independently? I was, how am I going to do my life? A cat eye winged eyeliner was my thing. She looked, so I was like, what am I going to do if I can't wear my eyeliner every day? But then one of the first things I asked my mum, though, I said, pinch my arm. She went, why? And I was like, just pinch it. I was like, I felt that. She was like, of course you're going to feel it. And I was like, I was hoping that I couldn't feel it, so that I could have got loads of tattoos before I got the sensation back without actually having to feel them. I could get a full sleeve done, get my leg tattooed, get my ribs done while I can't feel it, then that'd be great for me. Well,
have you got yourself now another tattoo that's got something to do with your experience?
I have a brain tattooed on the side of my head next to my scar from my surgery. I knew I wanted to get a brain tattoo done, but I thought, what's the point? I thought, all my other friends that have had surgeries, but they have them next to their scars. So I thought, you know what? why not get it on the side of my head next to it? And my argument was to my family when they were like, no, it's not a good idea to get a head tattoo, Molly. I was like, yeah, but my hair, I'll be able to cover it up with my hair if I need to. I can just grow my hair out. Not realising that after radiotherapy, my hair will never grow back on that side now.
You see people shave the bit underneath and then they flick their hair over the other side and then they choose which way you want it. Yeah. Quite a popular thing to do now, isn't it? So it would be perfect to then, here's my brain tumor, and put it back and be like, let's forget about it. Bring it back.
But one of my first thoughts when I was diagnosed was, am I going to lose my hair? Because back in the day, I used to have basically every hair colour going. Mm. I've had every hair colour you could think of. So my hair was a big deal for me. So I was a bit like, oh, I don't want to lose my hair. Mm. And that was one of my main concerns was, am I going to lose my hair? But then luckily, when I had my first surgery, they shaved the side of my head. But and I'd wanted that done for years, but I never had the courage to actually do it. So I finally got it done. But I think now, if only the 15-year-old me that wanted it done so badly but wasn't allowed it because I was getting trouble at school, but my mum knew I'd get in trouble at school for it, if that Molly would know that I would have a side shave for the rest of my life, would think it was quite cool. So then I woke up from the surgery, couldn't walk, and was obviously stuck in Derriford for a few weeks. They were trying to get me transferred to a rehab unit at my local hospital so that my mum wasn't having to drive back and forward to Plymouth every day. Mm. And eventually a bed came free on a stroke unit. And it was the only kind of like rehabilitation and neuro ward they could put me on in my local hospital. And within 24 hours, my mum brought me because they weren't looking after me. I'd just got there. I'd been transferred there. I'd missed my medication. I'd missed my steroids at Derriford because I was being transferred. Got there. They wouldn't give me any steroids till a doctor came and checked me in. 24 hours later, about a week after brain surgery, wasn't allowed any painkillers other than paracetamol. I wasn't allowed to be given my steroids. At this point, I was having like severe headaches because the steroids to reduce the swelling in your brain. I've not been given them 24 hours. So my brain's I'm obviously suffering with swelling. And my mum brought me out and took me home. She's an occupational therapist. So she spoke to her boss at work and said, am I being stupid if I take her home? She said, no, you're doing the complete right thing. And luckily, when they found out I was being discharged, I was sent an occupational therapist from the hospital around and said, we can get this and this, but we can't get it ordered till tomorrow morning. And one of them goes, can I go pick it up? And obviously she knew the guys that work. She knew the guys from the place where you go pick up the equipment anyway from her job. So she just went and picked it all up on the way home. But on the way home, because I hadn't been given my steroids, she gave me one. As soon as we left, she gave me one. She gave me one from our own medication.
Yeah.
We'd literally just nearly got home. And the neurological nurse at the hospital in Plymouth, where our nurse who was our like point of contact at Plymouth, she'd heard that my mum had discharged me, and she obviously rang up to see what had happened and why she was taking me home and checking that obviously we were all right and everything. And we were very nearly home, and my mum's got her on speakerphone, and she's certainly going to have to go, Molly's thrown up all over the car. Because again, I hadn't been given my steroids for 24 hours.
Oh, that must have been really...
But then obviously... And then at that point then, my mum was having to take... My mum, every day... I had to move into the dining room and have the dining room as a bedroom for a while. I couldn't get up and down the steps.
Yeah.
And I was having to, and we didn't have a downstairs bathroom. So I was having to everything. I was like,
yeah.
So it was a commode in the bedroom, a little bed in the dining room, because we never used it as a dining room. And my mum would have to come and wash me in the dining room and everything, help me get dressed, help me on and off the sofa and stuff, and then take me to physio every day.
Yeah. When were they able to then give you the correct medication so that you were feeling a lot better?
When we were back home, basically. Oh, my mum had it all on her, but she couldn't give me it in the hospital. Her fear was that if she gave me the steroid and then she goes off to the toilet and the doctor finally comes and gives me some, I'm just out of brain surgery. I might not remember the fact that I've already been given them. I might end up taking a double dose then, so... She couldn't give me them in hospital for the risk that I might end up actually getting them after she's given them to me. And also, she's not allowed to give them to me in the hospital.
Mm.
So as soon as we left, she gave me one. But obviously, it took a while to kick in, you know, off for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Especially because when you get given the steroid, it was ridiculous that they did this, though. Because when you get given the steroids, you have to carry a card around with you that says, I am on a steroid medication that cannot suddenly be stopped. Yet, they let me miss two doses in hospital.
You were really let down on a few of these things. That's... sad.
Yeah.
You had radiotherapy.
That was a few years later, to be fair, because I'm back home after my surgery. My mum's taken me to physio. I probably went back home about the last week of November. And then it was like the first, and then it was like around the week, it was Boxing Day. I can specifically remember being able to walk around the house. I was walking around the house, but with a walking stick, very slowly. Still needing the odd help getting dressed and stuff. And I could just about walk around the house, just about managed to walk around the house. And then we went shopping. We still had to take the wheelchair because I'd get too tired to go to just walk around. So I was still going places in a wheelchair, but I could just about walk around the house and stuff like that. And I could do steps at this point. So I was finally able to move back into my own bedroom, which was a relief, and be able to actually go to the bathroom upstairs. Then that was 2 years later. So I'm just having 6 months, every 6 months I'm going for an MRI just to keep track of how, obviously check that. He's called Brian, is the brain tumour.
Oh, you've named him or it.
He's called Brian. So they were just basically checking that Brian hadn't grown back. And so every 6 months they're doing it. And then they were happy. They were satisfied with my scan. So they put me onto 9 months then. Oh no, they put me onto yearly scans because they were satisfied. But I was getting these really bad headaches. And at the time I thought they were just stress headaches. I just moved out of like my mum's house into my own flat. So I thought it was just stress headaches, trying to work out a move and everything and all this sort of stuff and the packing and everything like that. So, but the GP wouldn't give me any painkillers until I went for an MRI to obviously whatever. I book in an MRI, go and have it done. And then I was actually in Manchester with my friend. It was like the week after the MRI. I'm in Manchester with my friend and I was at my auntie's house getting ready because we were going to see Harry Styles that night.
Oh,
I fucking love Harry Styles. Me, Harry Styles is my man. He's been my man now for nearly 14 years, which is scary because I have given that man more than half of my life, and he's still not had the cheek to call me. He still had the nerve to not call me that.
Yeah, but also probably your money.
A lot of money. A lot. Growing up, it was a lot of my mum's money, but and he's still not called me that. But then, although I have had 3 hugs out of him, so that's all good.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was when I was a teenager. I met One Direction in Manchester a good few times. I used to go to like their signings that they did.
Yeah.
Like CD signings. My mum used to have to go get up at like 3 a.m. and go sleep on the streets in Manchester for me to get me a ticket.
Oh, that's amazing. Your mum sounds awesome.
She is. She's a pretty cool lady. But my surgeon had always said to me, he'd always said, if you have an MRI scan and you don't hear from us, that's good news. If you hear from us, that's when it might not be such good news. Yeah. And I get a call on my phone. I'm my auntie's house putting my makeup on. My phone goes and I see that it says the location is Plymouth. And I thought, this ain't going to be good. And it was my nurse from the hospital, my neurological nurse at the hospital. And is there any chance you can come in tomorrow because we need to discuss your scan? And I was like, oh God. And I was like, I can't. I'm in Manchester. I'm seeing Harry Styles tonight. But I was like, I can come in the end of the week. And she was like, yeah, come in. She was like, so I got back from Manchester. The next day, me and my mum drove up to Plymouth to find out that Brian had doubled in size from the part that was left after the surgery.
How long was that from between the surgery until then?
That would have been 2 years. That was about 2 years. So Brian had doubled in size. And my surgeon, he was waiting. I didn't know. And he said, we don't know whether we're going to operate or try radiotherapy. Because he was waiting to get some advice from some other brain surgeons. And he wanted to get their advice on what to do with my, I'll obviously send over my whole case and be like, should we operate or should we not? And he knew that I was hesitant about operating it again because of what happened after the second operation. And he knew how hard I'd learned to, how long it had taken me to learn to walk again, how much effort I'd put in with that. I knew that the risks were quite high. So they decided to give radiotherapy a go. Then about 2 or 3 months later, I started radiotherapy. Oddly enough, I started radiotherapy on the 2-year anniversary of me being diagnosed with my brain tumour.
What do you do on the 6th of July now?
We often go out for a meal or something, or I'll go out and have a few drinks with my mate. Last year on the 6th of July, me and my mates went and did karaoke. And of course, when we got there, they were like, we're putting your first song in. And they put in I'm Still Standing by Elton John, which is one of my favourite songs.
Perfect.
Put that in for me on the 6th of July. They had to put in I'm Still Standing by Elton John on that anniversary.
That's a good one.
So then I went and had had 6.5 weeks of radiotherapy. And they told us before, they said, look, the aim of the radiotherapy is not to get rid of the tumour, it's just to stop it growing. And actually, they did manage to shrink it a bit in size. And that was 5 years ago, and there's still no growth. Because I had a scan done last August because they wanted to do it in August because that was 5 years since I finished radiotherapy, so they wanted to be able to compare it to the last scan I had after radiotherapy to 5 years on, and yeah, there's no growth on it at all. In fact, it shrunk a bit from the start of radiotherapy.
That must have been a good feeling to have, you weren't expecting it to be that good.
No, I'm on yearly scan.
Are you allowed to drive?
The brain tumour damaged the optic nerves, and I've still to this day can't see on the left side of both eyes. In fact, yesterday I had an eye test done, and when they did the visual field test, the optician went, I had to go off, and he went off and showed all the other opticians my results, and none of them could believe that it's a direct line down the middle of both eyes is where I can and can't see. I'll never be allowed to drive until Elon Musk comes out with a self-driving car that's safe enough that I don't need any control over it.
I'm the same. I can't drive because I've lost my... I can look forward, but if you're in front of me, I can only see one of your eyes, so I can't see the other half of your face until I turn my head. I'm still waiting for a miracle so I can drive again. Really miss that.
I never could drive, so I don't know what I'm missing. Everybody in my family has pretty much always driven, so it's like always been a thing that growing up I was like, yeah, I'll drive and everything, and you realize now there's often things where I think that's something I'll never be able to do because I can't drive.
Like you say, hopefully Elon Musk is going to come and change all that.
So one of the symptoms that I hadn't noticed was, one of them was the eyesight, and because it was a problem with my brain and not the eyes, I wasn't aware that I'd lost half of my vision in both eyes, because your brain just tells you that you can see everything, which means that when I go out anywhere, I have to constantly remind myself that I can't see everything. Mm. Even how many years is it now? 7 years down the line, I still have to remind myself that I still can't see everything. Yeah. Especially when I'm crossing roads, I have to remember that I don't actually know until I turn my head and look.
Mm.
So I wasn't aware of the eyesight, so I wasn't bringing it up to the doctors, because obviously, like I say, my brain was overcompensating for me. But then another symptom that I wasn't aware of was that the left side of my face looked like I'd had a stroke. And I wasn't aware of it because you don't really look at your own face that often. Mm. And it was more noticeable when I was talking, and I don't look and stand in the mirror and talk to myself, so I wouldn't know. All of my friends had noticed it. They didn't bring it up to me because they were worried it might be something that they all obviously thought I knew about it, thought I'd be self-conscious about it. And my mum didn't bring it up to me because she didn't want to worry me. Mm. And my brother had said to my mum, he said, Mum, what's up with Molly's face? And she goes, don't tell her. I don't think she's aware of it. I don't want her to worry about it. And then, so I wasn't aware, but a GP should, I've been told by other doctors since, that's what's known as a hard symptom. And that straight away, they should have picked up on that, whether I was telling them about it or not. And I should have straight away been sent for tests. But two whole different surgeries, completely just missed that.
It's weird how you think I've given you all these different things and none of you are putting it together, and you think, gosh, why don't you know that?
Also, I was really failed by Specsavers. It was 2 months before I was diagnosed. I went for an eye test. They didn't pick up on the fact that I'd lost half of my eyesight in both eyes.
Did they give you a
visual field test? No, because they didn't, because I, at the time, they don't just give them people my age. They only give them to you if you're over a certain age or you've got eye conditions or a family history of those conditions. When I had the eye test yesterday, when they do the thing where they take the photo of the back of your eye?
Yeah.
And the optician yesterday said, as if they wouldn't have picked up on the fact that you're, because they're taking a photo of the optic nerve. And he said, it's so obviously damaged. Mm. My optic nerve is really badly damaged. So even from just taking a photo of the back of my eye, they should have noticed there was an issue with it.
And seen raising, they would have seen pressure.
They just sent me away with glasses for watching TV. That was it.
I feel like you've been really unlucky. My opticians found mine, and I know many others who did.
I go to Boots now because they're so much. I go to Boots because, one, they've got nicer glasses, and two, they actually seem more interested and more aware of things. Although for a while, I was so angry with Specsavers because their TV advert campaign was, come for an eye test. An eye test can detect early signs of medical condition. And I was like, you didn't with mine.
Mm.
Yeah. And when my mum emailed them after we'd found out about my brain tumor, my mum emailed them, not to say, like, she emailed the specific store, not to be like, this is your fault. And obviously, it's not their fault I've got a brain tumor or whatever. But just to make them aware that obviously I'd been for an eye test like 2 or 3 weeks earlier and they hadn't picked up on it. And their answer was, well, clearly she hadn't lost any vision by the time she came to her. I'm like, and my mum's like, there's no way she could have lost that much vision that quickly with a brain tumour that's on the optic nerve.
Mm. It's hard not to feel a bit let down.
Exactly, yeah. And I can pinpoint a time from a year before when I look back and I think, yeah, I remember walking to work, walking into a lamppost for no reason. It was right in front of me. I should have seen it, but it was on the left, so I didn't see it. giving myself concussion and dropping and smashing my phone on the floor. I remember it mainly because I dropped my phone and smashed my phone and it cost me 100 quid to get it fixed. Yeah. But that at that point, that is a pinpoint that a year before I'd already started to lose eyesight. Yeah. But
you know the posts that they're quite short and they tend to stop you going down a road, little pillar thing. I've walked into them so many times because they're in the wrong part of my vision. And oh my gosh, I remember hitting that on a night out once because it was dark. I couldn't really see it. And I just whacked into my side and the bruise. And I remember I tried to suave it out. I was like, it's okay. I didn't want anyone to know.
I get it. I walk into things all the time to the point where my friends think it's hilarious. If I go out with a friend, my friends have turned this into a drinking game on a night out.
Yeah.
Every time somebody notices, I apologize to an inanimate object after bumping it.
They get a shot.
Everybody but the person who points it out has to drink. It's become a thing now. A drinking game. Someone's like, just apologize to the table. Everybody but me has to drink. And everybody has to have a drink, especially me. I have to drink as well.
Yeah.
Although sometimes I notice it and I go, I'm like, I just apologize that. And I'm like, you're setting us up now. You're making us all drink. I'm like, I'm not. Because I'm always apologizing to, I apologize to my own sofa 3 or 4 times a day to bump into it. And I'm so used to bumping into things when there are people. And it's just automatic response that I walk into something and just to say sorry in case it is a person.
Have you found you've hit children or someone in a wheelchair or something and you're like, oh my gosh, take me into the ground.
My worst one is elderly people.
Yeah. No, me too.
I think I'm just a rude young person. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm not. I'm visually impaired. I see you there. But one time, I remember when I was first coming to terms with my eyesight loss, I was out with my white stick because I've got the... Something that I feel like a lot of people don't know is the difference between what the different white sticks mean.
A white stick
with red stripes on it means that somebody is deaf and blind. A white stick with a ball on the end means somebody is like registered as blind. Mm. Although it's very rare that people always assume that if you're blind, you can't see anything at all. Yeah. That's very rare for someone to be blind and not see anything. A lot of the time it's that they're blind. They can see light. If you were stood in front of a window, they could see that you were stood there, but they couldn't tell who you were.
Mm.
But a stick with a white ball on the end means that they're like that. They have very poor vision. They can't distinguish what things are. So the white ball helps them tell what things are and where things are and if they're going to bump into them. But a white stick without a ball on the end is called a symbol cane. That's what I have. Because I still have good enough vision that I can walk around and about fine without a stick. Like, I can get myself around. But it's called a symbol cane because it's to show other people that I have sight loss.
Well, I didn't know
that. So it's basically so other people are aware to move out of my way. Or if I bump into them, it's because I can't see you properly. If you get in touch with your local sensory team, they give you one.
That's really interesting. I never really thought of that. I've always tried to probably be a little bit in denial. I'm okay. Even though you whack into something, you're like, oh, okay, I'm not that okay.
The first time I went out with my stick and I was just adjusting to losing my eyesight, the fact that I was obviously just going out with vision loss, I hit somebody with the stick and they got really mad at me. And my brother had to go, excuse me, did you not see what she just hit you with? She hit you with her white cane. She couldn't see you. You were in her way. I've been in my flat for 5 years now.
Yeah.
And I still, every day, walk into my sofa multiple times a day.
You wonder why.
Walk into the banister.
Yeah,
into the door frame.
And it hurts. Yeah. So you got as many bruises as me.
I walk into my furniture all the time, but that's a lot of the time because, for example, my coffee table, walk into that all the time, but that's because I've got wooden floors and it's not grippy. And if my dog's having a play with his toys, he bumps into it all the time. So I move it. So it's always being moved a bit. And I've noticed that it's really clever what my dog's done. I haven't trained him to do this. He's figured this out himself. Because I used to always walk him on my right-hand side so I could see him. I've noticed. I think he must have noticed that I always bump into things on the left. So he now walks on my left knowing that I will have to leave a gap in between me and the thing that I might bump into because he's going to be there. He always chooses to walk on my left because he's noticed that. And I've noticed now he does that. I don't bump into as many things because he's there and I know to leave a gap for him.
Oh, that's really sweet. Dogs are so clever.
He was bought to help me recover from my brain surgeries, actually. He was bought to help me get over the brain surgeries and stuff.
Well,
and help me with my recovery. So.
Well, if you had some advice to give anybody else who was going through the sort of same thing as you, what would you say?
I'd say a few things. I'd say, one, don't care what other people think. You might lose people in your life, but it just shows that they weren't worth having in your life. If they're not willing to stay with you when you need people, then just let them go. You don't need them in your life. And two, never underestimate how much power and strength you can get from yourself. Like, I spent months in hospital thinking I would never walk again. Yeah. And nowadays, I'm out in the pub dancing. I'm out in the pub dancing on a weekend. Be yourself. Look at the positive side of things. So whenever anything, like, I've obviously had not the best time of it, but the way I look at it is, I've realised who my real friends are. I've made friends through it. And thanks to having a brain tumour, I got to meet one of my favourite bands, and one of my favourite musicians knows who I am thanks to it now. Yeah, it's just, you've just got to, not everything that happens is going to be a good thing, but you are going to get good things out of it. Like, for me, the one thing I always say is, if I could go back and not have a brain tumour, I wouldn't do it, because it's changed who I am as a person for the better. I've met people through it I never would have had, and I've had experiences through it that I never would have had.
Yeah.
And I'm more understanding about other people now as well.
Tell us a bit about the Brain Tumour Charity. What is it you're doing with them?
I don't do anything with them anymore, but I was a young ambassador for them for 2 years, which was like, it was a lot of it was around, like, I'd go help out at their event. We'd do we'd work on like fundraising stuff. And a lot of it was about raising awareness.
Did you enjoy it?
A lot of it was all about raising awareness. I loved it. Yeah, it was great. But then when that finished, because the Young Ambassador Programme is a 2-year programme, and sadly, my second year of it was during COVID, so I ended up missing out. I didn't get to go to as many events. But nowadays, I do public speaking for Young Lives versus Cancer.
How do you feel doing that? Do you get a real buzz, or do you get nervous?
I do, yeah. I don't know, but I don't really get nervous, but I think I always say, like, when I'm at karaoke and stuff, people come up to me like, how could I be as confident as you? I'm like, trust me, I have way more confidence than one person should ever have in life. It's terrifying how confident I am. Because I just go, yeah, no, I'll do this thing. And then I'm like, I'm going to get to that thing. And I'm like, why did I say yes to this? For example, my first public speaking event I did for the charity was to about 15 people. It was, this guy was holding like a spinathon event. That was to about like 15 people. And then after that, I went from 15 people to 500 teenage boys at the boys' grammar school. That one, I think, was potentially the most terrifying one I've done, because it was a room full of teenage boys. It would have been scary if it was the girls' grammar school.
Yeah. Well, you
would have been more scared to speak to 500 teenage girls than 500 teenage boys. I was on, there was a documentary. It was a BBC Horizons documentary called Teenagers versus Cancer. And I was filmed on that when I was at a Teenage Cancer Trust event. This event, it was up in the Midlands, and I was part of the Southwest group that was going. So, of course, I was with the Bristol lot, and they'd given them like a little camera to do some like filming over the weekend and stuff. Even though they were there and filming themselves, they'd obviously given little cameras.
Yeah.
And so the lad who had the camera was interviewing me on the way up there. You can see me in my Harry Styles t-shirt on the way up there. But that weekend, every weekend, it was a great event. I went twice. It was like a conference. You could choose which different like things you wanted to go to. But every year, it was at like a Hilton Hotel in the Midlands.
Yeah.
And on the Saturday night, which was the last night there, we'd go on Friday, come home on Sunday. So on the last night there, Saturday night, they always did and a bit of a party, and it was always fancy dress with a theme every year. The first year I went, the theme was heroes and villains. I won best hero. I went dressed as Tyker.
Oh, did you show him?
I sent a photo over to the neurological nurse, and she straight away printed, because she'd had to sign off my forms to say that obviously I was well enough to go.
Mm.
And she printed the photos out, took them over to Titus, and he's got them stuck up on the wall of his office.
Oh, nice. So he's literally a mate now.
Yeah.
Is there anything you would want to say thank you to as a thank you?
I have two people. I want to say a huge thank you to Titus, because he never lets us, whenever we try and say, I'll try and thank him because he saved my life. My mum tries to thank him because if it wasn't for him, she wouldn't have a daughter anymore. And he won't let us say thank you because it's my job. I'm, yes, but if it wasn't for your job, Molly wouldn't be here. So I want to say a big thank you to Titus, my absolute superhero. I will never find a man that will be a bigger hero than Titus. I want to say a huge thank you to my mum for spending nights sleeping on a mattress on the floor in the hospital. for helping me get on and off the toilet, for helping me shower, dressing me for mums, driving me back and forth to appointments. And at the time, I wasn't thankful for this, but for forcing me to do my physio. Then if she hadn't have forced me, I wouldn't be where I am now. A thank you to my dad for driving a 600-mile round trip every time I had to have a surgery and when I had radiotherapy. Thank you to my brother for the amount of times you have to drive me to the supermarkets because I'm blind and can't drive myself. And thank you to any of my friends that have actually been there and supported me and didn't just leave the second things got tough. To my little dog, because he's the one that keeps me going. I was having radiotherapy. In fact, I'll send you this photo over for the article. Mm. I'd come in, I'd be absolutely exhausted after having radiotherapy. I'd be so exhausted that I'd just go for a nap. And my mum would come in to check on me and check I was all right. And he'd always be in there with me. He was always in the bed looking out, watching over me. Whether he was having a nap with me or whether he was just sat there looking after me, bless him. And a friend that I met just before I had radiotherapy. And I met her actually through a band. And we both ended up going to this band gig in Exeter and then in Bristol. And we always got on really well. This was just before my radiotherapy. And then about 2 years after I had my radiotherapy, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And then she went through it all and everything. And I feel like that brought us together stronger because we both knew what we'd been through. But she'd always been so supportive. When we went away, the band that we'd met through, we went away to follow them around our UK tour. We went to do the whole tour. It was like a 5-day tour of the UK. And she'd noticed when we got to Newcastle, I was exhausted and I was struggling with my suitcase. And straight away, her suitcase was much easier one to manage because mine had two wheels, hers had four, and hers was a bit lighter than mine. And she straight away was like, look, Mal, do you want to swap suitcases? Because she said, mine's a bit easier to manage. She swapped suitcases. I don't mind carrying yours for a bit. But also, we went to Bristol. We went on a night out in Bristol, went to a DJ set in Bristol. And when we got to the hostel we were staying in, normally the beds are made for you, but these ones you had to make your own, make the bed. They gave you the bedding, but you had to put it on. And she noticed me struggling with it. But my favourite thing about this was that she didn't just come over and take over. She comes over and she watched me for a while, noticed that I was struggling, then thought she'd come over and ask if I wanted help, knowing that I probably wouldn't ask her and say, can you do this for me? But she comes over and she'd ask whether I needed the help. She didn't just come over and
do it.
Just take over. She asked if I wanted help with it.
Thank you that you took the time and telling us your story and also being a part of Brain Tumor Awareness Month.
It's all right. I always like to do my bit on Brain Tumor Awareness Month.
Thank you for having me. This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.